Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to a new series of The First Time here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. And we start this new series with a legendary singer, an artist whose musical journey has seen him travel to all corners of the world for inspiration, from rock and roll in black country clubs to stadiums as the frontman of one of the biggest bands of all time, then immersing himself in Nashville country, Middle Eastern trance, South Asian devotional Sufi music, New Orleans Creole and bluegrass, while all the time keeping his feet on the ground in his birthplace of the Midlands. No small achievement. I'm very proud to say my guest on The First Time this week is Robert Plant. Here we chat about his very earliest influences, the impact of the first rock and roll singles, and the emerging blues scene in the 60s that would see him partner up with the drummer John Bonham, and what happened when the pair of them became half of Led Zeppelin. We also talk about the fallout of that experience and his acclaimed collaboration with Alison Krauss. Plus, we talk about his ongoing band, the sensational Spaceshifters, who released their last album, Carry Fire, earlier this year. But I started by asking Robert, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Well, I think we were graced in those days by... There's a lot more directive, probably from the BBC, directing music straight at kids. I mean, not for any commercial gain, but just because kids had a long childhood. You know, there was no sort of, you weren't revving into the swinging 60s or anything like that. You were in the kind of post-war early to mid 50s. I always looked forward to listen with mother at 1:45, where there was a little, like a glockenspiel that had a little theme.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
And I'd sit down next to my mom, I suppose. I was about 3 or 4. I had a very interesting and exaggerated couple of decades in the 60s and 70s, but some things are still there. So I heard these little kind of chimes, and that was... I knew that something great was going to happen after that. And that's how I view music, really. When I hear something that's really good, I think something great's going
to
happen.
To this day.
Yeah, yeah. So that was what it was. I heard Listen with Mother, and on a Saturday morning, there was Uncle Mac's Children's Favourites, where you would hear Nelly the Elephant and Runaway Train and of course, The Laughing Policeman. And Christopher Robin, you know, goes down with Alice, in the nicest possible way, to Buckingham Palace, I think.
The changing guard at Buckingham Palace. Christopher Robin went down with Alice. Alice is marrying one of the guard. A soldier's life is terrible hard, says Alice.
So that was the kickoff, but I was, you know, not even 5 years old, but I already got it. There was a song called Sparky's Magic Piano, which was a vocoder, of course. I think now Cher's got all the vocoders in the world in a wardrobe.
Sparky, oh, Sparky.
Who's that? Who's calling me?
It is I, your piano.
My piano? But you're talking.
Yes, I can talk.
It was just far out to hear American productions. They were really confident. As I got a little bit older and I started listening to Two-Way Family Favourites on a Sunday, which was a kind of exchange of greetings from British servicemen, probably in Cyprus or Aden or wherever it was that we were getting busy, they would be sending messages back to mom and dad somewhere in the Rhondda Valley. So, you know, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of Kathy Kirby, but now and again, through it all, came Little Richard.
Well, this is it. When was the first, I mean, the thunderbolt? When was that moment of, oh, okay,
I think it was the piano riff and the rhythm section on Lucille by Little Richard.
We'll be right back.
Still was not in sight. I asked my friends about her, but all they did was talk. Lucy, please come back while you belong. I've been good to you, baby. Please don't leave me alone. Lucy, baby, satisfy my heart. Lucy, baby, satisfy my heart. I play fine with you, baby. The days are such a wonderful start.
I mean, there was the sweetness of the Everlys, which was stunning. I mean, those harmonies from the Everlys. But you had this thing going on with Little Richard and his band, the Upsetters. Lucille, Long Tall Sally, Good Golly, Miss Molly, you know, all that stuff was like... And it was so good that Elvis was covering it too, but we didn't know that either because we only ever were exposed really to a lot of his singles, you know. We didn't have a record player or anything then.
What was the first live music experience that you saw, that you went to, that really changed things, that shifted the world on its axis for you a little bit?
Well, variety shows on the TV were one thing.
Yeah, but know. That's not like live, no. In the room.
Well, at school there was a band in the Black Country called Dave Lacey and the Corvettes, and they were...
That's a good name.
Yeah. They had the band jackets, sort of cerise band jackets with black velvet collars.
And nice.
They were really good, very good. And they were doing things like George Jones's The Race Is On and stuff. And so to be like 14 at school and go and see these guys, you went into the doors of the place, and maybe a youth club or maybe a ballroom, and the doors would swing open. And it's just like a movie, you know, the doors open and the smell of sweat and perfume and those... amazing skirts and dresses with lots of petticoats underneath and...
The lights. The
yeah, and there was no dry ice then either. No smoke. But it was just like... I was peeping into a world which was definitely 5 or 6 years ahead of where I was at.
Yeah.
But I was just tantalised by it. It was just... What is that?
That was it?
Yeah. It was just an altered state. And that's what it is. It's an altered state. The whole deal about movement and music.
Of course.
Which takes me right to North Africa and Mali and stuff, where it's trance music and moving.
Your first performance, was it with Perry Foster? Is that right?
Well, yeah, I suppose Perry Foster is quite a sort of luminary, and he's like a kind of torch for stories of... visiting blues musicians in the 60s.
Right. I mean,
he was employed by Lippmann and Rau, who were the German promoters who first bought Bucker White and Son Haas, Skip James, all these great Delta blues guys. He also bought Sonny Boy Williamson. Perry was employed looking after Sonny Boy, who was like a 6'4" black guy from Tutwiler, Mississippi, who was taking no prisoners. And as a matter of fact, it was quite interesting, really, because it was a time where the British public, music... loving public, were into quite great psychedelia and into blues. And so Sonny Boy managed to get a chart position with a song called Help Me that my mum and dad agreed to buy for me when I came top in geography at school when I was 14 or whatever.
You got to help me. I can't do it all by myself. You got to help me, baby. I can't do it all by myself. You know, if you don't help me, darling, I'll have to find myself somebody else. I may have to wash it, may have to sew, I may have to cook, I might mop the floor, but you help me, baby. You know, if you don't help me, darling, I'll find myself somebody else. Thank you. me. Oh, baby, I can't do it all by myself. You know, if you don't help me, darling, I'll have to find myself somebody else.
So Perry looked after Sonny Boy, kept an eye on him, helped him out of hotel rooms, and he had a couple of three bands, the Delta Blues Band, the Memphis New Memphis Blues Breakers, and I was playing washboard.
Really?
I didn't sing, yeah, I hadn't started singing.
Just trying to imagine what your career would have been like if you just become really good at the washboard and never quite started singing.
Some friends of mine down in Memphis have got a gig, they're called the North Mississippi All-Stars, and they're two brothers, Lucer and Cody Dickinson, and the one guy plays washboard, that's his trick.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But, sound.
Well, sorry, when you strap it around your chest and you've got two fingers full of...
The chains.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So, yeah, so they gave me a gig playing washboard, and I really tried to get it right. I'm still trying to get rhythm right. And then at school, there was a group called the Andy Long and the Original Jurymen, which were playing kind of R&B, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley stuff. And Andy got sick one night, and they knew I knew all the words. I used to go to the gigs with them. I was about 14, 15. And Andy got sick, and they said, well, come on then, Planty, get up. So... And when you're on the golden platform, then you go, oh. So I'd spent all my time from Nelly the Elephant through to just looking up.
Following the spotlight.
Into that stuff. But I'd never been up there looking back down at the circular skirts and white stilettos. I'd never seen that from that angle. We're all sort of giving it large and getting some starch and making sure our collars are up. And we're all trying to be Billy Fury or whoever it is. So, it's ironic, really. So many things I can't remember.
But so many things you can.
Yeah. I've been offered a million times in a million different ways to put some of my stories together as a book, but I can't do that. But what I can do is remember that that first gig in a pop band was at the Rink in Swaddling Coat in Derbyshire because I was so frightened.
Can you remember the song or one of the songs that you did?
I'm a Lover, Not a Fighter, which is, I think, a Lazy Lester track.
I met a pretty girl, as pretty as can be. I thought she was my baby, yeah, she introduced to me. A great big tall fella, about 6'4". I shivered and I sure couldn't do any more, 'cause I'm a lover, not a fighter. Gone, 'cause I'm a lover, not a fighter. Yes, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I'm a lover, not a fighter, and I'm really built for speed. Built for speed. Built for speed. But sometimes I think maybe I got rabbit blood in me, 'cause I'm a lover, not a fighter. Yes, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I'm a lover, not a fighter, and I'm really built for speed. Built for speed. Built for speed.
I have to ask you about the first time you played with John, the first time you had that behind you, that sound.
Well, it became evident as I went into the second year fifth at school. At one point at the school I was at, it was considered that I might go on to great academic sort of acclaim. And they had me sort of penciled in for some fancy university. And
to study what? What would you have done?
Well, I wanted to study Romano-British archaeology.
Okay.
Mm. And I wanted to just get into the Dark Age history of Britain, you know, which I have done in song since, much to everybody's...
Don't put it down.
That's no, great. I'm not putting it down I, you know, I have a channel towards it through it. And, but I joined a band called the Crawling Kingsnakes, and having been in a previous band called the Black Snake Moan, these are all references to the phallus. and they're also songs by Black Snake Moan was a Blind Lemon Jefferson song. I always start my mornings with that.
Really?
Yeah, every morning. It's just amazing. So I was playing at the plazas, the place that when the door swung open, there it all was. But now I was actually master of ceremonies, introducing the top acts of the day. And I was also the guy that started the show in my band, and the Crawling Kingsnakes. And I saw this guy in the crowd looking up, sort of scowling, but looking definitely like he was on a mission. He said to me, he said, "You're all right." He said, "But you'd be a lot better if you had the best drummer in the world behind you." I said, "Yeah, yeah. I suppose you're him." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, good. Well, that sounds all right. But where do you live?" And he said, "Redditch." And I said, "Oh, so you've got a sense of humour then?" I said, "But Redditch is like 25 miles from where we live. We can't afford the fuel to go and pick you up. So if you want to try it out, these are the songs we do. Just come along and play, but you make your own way there."
You get your own ticket, mate.
So he came with Pat and he joined the Kingsnakes, and never a dull moment, really, until 1980 between us. He ran away a lot. He got offers where people were actually making money, and he stayed with me in the band of Joy with some of the great musicians, but the music was too fringe. But one time we were playing the Speakeasy Club in London, which was a really amazing place. I'd seen Hendrix play there and Arthur Lee. And the Band of Joy were really short of gigs. We could probably play about two or three successful places in Britain where people got the drift of what we were doing. But it was psychedelic blues. We were on a circuit with... We were the kind of poor cousins of the Steam Packet with Rod Stewart and Long John Baldry and Julie Driscoll. And... There was a lot of freak beat stuff still going on, the action and the British Birds, the Artwoods. And I met Terry Reid at that time. He was playing, and Victor Brox's Blues Train. So we got the opportunity to play at the Speakeasy. And we were starting to get a name, even though we couldn't come into the pop world.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have been cool. And also...
But you could feel it. There's
something was there, but it was not... Is mass recognition the answer to everything? I don't know. You know, here I am saying that. It was almost accidental for me and my companions down the line. So we set up at the Speak, and the night just about to start, we were unloading the van, and we realised that John Bonham had the van, the Band of Joy van, and backed it up to some railings in Dudley to make sure nobody could nick the gear.
Yep, classic.
So we drove to Wigmore Street in West End, get out the van to unload the stuff, and realise that we've left the door handle in the railings back in Dudley, so it won't come out, you can't get in there. So there was a guy working on the roads, and I said, "Lend us that shovel." So Bonzo got hold of the shovel and starts prising the door of the back of the van, and down, this is true, down the street coming towards us, towards the zebra crossing, is a Rolls Royce, and it's Keith Moon. So Bonzo throws the shovel to me, because drummers are not to be seen pricing their way into the group van. And then Mooney had got a microphone inside the car, and he would get to a zebra crossing, and when somebody's walking across, he'd shout at them through the radiator grill, and they would drop their shopping. So there was this great sort of moment of... I've got the shovel. Mooney's shouting at some lady with some shopping, and Bonzo's hiding. And then we set up on the stage, and John would, he was desperate to get away from anything I did. And he's Patty's missus said, you can't play with him anymore. There's nothing happening here. You're not going to make any money with him. So John's set up right on the very front of the stage. So that's usually where the singer goes, up the sharp end. But instead of that, I had to give a little to him. And he was doing all these tricks, playing with one stick and spinning the other one in the air, round and round, and doing all these ridiculous fills while we were playing White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane. It was great, but... We fought our way through the mid to late 60s, he and I. You know, it was a lot of funny, absolutely hysterical stuff. It's just so cute. It's really cute stuff that transpired, and it was always just so funny. You know, I mean, because we don't know the ways of the world when you're 17.
17, good God.
We did good. You know, John went off and worked with Tim Rose for a while. I had a hit with Morning Dew. And I went and worked with Alexis Corner. And then things changed again.
This is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Robert Plant, and that was Good Times, Bad Times from 1969, the first track from Led Zeppelin's first album.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
Ooh. Dressed up with love, across the seven seas to you. Oh, will it be enough? And I will be a rainbow. Oh, now your storm is gone. And I will bring the song for you. And I will carry on. I will bring their beauty home because of my love.
storm is gone, and I will bring my song to you, and I'll carry on. But the voice of complaining, my hands shall not tremble, my feet shall not falter, the void shall not weary, the fear shall not alter. This rainbow, oh, this rainbow, oh, can you see the eyes of the lovers? A pocket full of hearts, a world that's filled with love, a love that carries all before, a passion in the flood. I lie beneath the rainbow, now your tears have gone, and I'll sing my song for you, and I'll carry on.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career, and my guest this week is Robert Plant. And that was Rainbow, taken from Robert's 2014 sensational Space Shifters album, Lullaby and the Ceaseless Roar. As this is a show about firsts, I did have to ask Robert about the events leading up to the first Led Zeppelin rehearsal in 1968, when he and his friend drummer John Bonham played with guitarist Jimmy Page and bassist John Paul Jones.
John and I were definitely pleased with ourselves. We thought in the Midlands, we never said it, well, actually John said it, we thought we were really something far out, because we were both reaching for stuff musically that was not just, I got the blues about my baby. You know, it was like, well, this kind of mimicking vocal thing that I started to create, all this kind of on that side of things, and John was playing some ridiculously cool stuff. And it was beyond just playing in a pub and singing Roll Over Beethoven. It was like we didn't have any other songs except for psychedelic blues-based stuff. But we were on some kind of mission, and there was no way through until Jimmy Page came with Peter Grant and Chris Dreyer to a teacher's training college in Birmingham where I was singing with a group. And they asked me where Robert Plant was, and I looked at them and I thought, I'll tell him it's that guy over there. And anyway, I think the band was not great. And we were singing Buffalo Springfield songs, you know. I didn't think it was a particularly expressive night on my part. And they talked to me for a bit and they said, we'll be in touch. And I thought, well, you know, these guys, that guy's from the Yardbirds. They had hits. And I knew that they were operating in America more than here. And I knew that Terry Reid, who's been my lifelong friend, he told me, they wanted Terry in the band, you know, Jimmy did. He had his own thing going on with Mickey Most at the time, which was great. He said, you got to go and see this guy in the Midlands. He's mad and wild. But I wasn't mad or wild that night. I just felt like, what am I doing here?
You got to see this guy. He's mild and he's...
Wad.
He's all right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I just... anyway, there we are. So that's what happened. I guess they must have been to see other people as well. I don't know. I've known Jimmy for like 50 years and I still don't know if they saw anybody else.
Really? You never
asked? Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah. I haven't got a clue.
Spend my days with a woman and kind, smoke my stuff and drank all my wine. Made up my mind, made make a new start. I'm going to California with an ache in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair. I didn't see too many this time.
One more Zepp question. I want to ask how you think, music aside, Led Zeppelin changed you. Because I would imagine that on the one hand, it's going to give you a worldview that's unique, and it's going to stretch your horizons in the most brilliant way. But I guess on the other side, it's going to open your eyes in a way that it's quite difficult to get that innocence back.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know, is that a fair...
Well, yeah, the end of innocence, I mean... But at the same time as all that, because of the tempo of life...
Then, yeah.
And because, really, it was uncharted territory to a large degree.
Because, to a great degree, yeah.
Yeah, because the Beatles had quit before they started doing these big... They did the one big gig there, and then...
You were the astronauts. You went out first.
Yeah. So, but all that was going on, but it was going so fast and so quick that we had no perspective, and there was no media coverage. We did have a PR agent to begin with, but they bailed out because it was doing it itself. I mean, you see, radio then in America was independent. Radio would... talk to radio in the next town, who would talk to radio in the next town. So the whole deal, by the time we got to town number 3 on our first tour, the streets were blocked. You couldn't get to the gig because the enthusiasm, and they were playing Zeppelin 1 on the radio, and, you know, it was, I don't know, I mean, me and Bonzo were looking at each other and hiding underneath the back seat of the car going, what's going on? So the end of innocence, well, you know, the thing is, it went so, everything was moving so quickly, but the bottom line was that both me and John lived very close to each other. We both came from the black country. We both got black country wives and black country women. And so we had to go back and do the big thing, like be dad, go to the football, you know, do everything that you would do if you were a civil engineer or if you were, you know, working in a coal mine. But of course, I try and figure it out now because I was only 20 when it kicked off.
Good God.
I'm 32 when it stopped.
Good God.
So really, I was growing as a man and as a father and dealing with crises that come through life anyway, and family and people's adjustment to who you have become.
Not just you, other people's perceptions.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's kind of interesting, really, because you do end up as an island quite often because of that, because no matter how much of a, as they say in the black country, a mucker that you are, people still want to know, well, I wonder, and of course I know the answers, and the answer is yes, yes and yes. So it was a bit of a sort of, it was like skating on thin ice, and I did grow up very ragged through it. And if I hadn't had the mates that I had all the way through, and if I had moved away from where I lived, then I probably would have had so much smoke blown up various areas of my body that I probably wouldn't know. By the time I was 40, I probably wouldn't have had a clue what was going on. So I've been very, very fortunate to... It's a long-standing love affair with travel, but it's a long-standing love affair with the homeland, you know.
Another massive first. Alison, when did you... What were your first impressions of Alison Krauss when you very first met her?
Well, I thought... Serenity.
Serenity, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I thought she was serene, elegant, beautiful, and she was a ripstitch. She was a rogue. She's got a wicked sense of humour, but very, very polite. I mean, this is a town in Nashville where I ended up. It's just so polite. Everybody's so charming after being in a rock and roll bands in England where it's dog eat dog and he's no good and oh, what's he doing over there?
Pulling the plug out of that amp.
Yeah, yeah. Like that's sort of small. The rock and roll scene was totally different to what it was there. She was very funny, and I agreed to give it a shot with her and T-Bone because prior to us trying to work out what Raising Sand was like, I'd been invited to play at the Cleveland, Ohio Symphony Hall in a tribute to Lead Belly with Harry Belafonte, Odetta, Clarence Greatmouth Brown and Los Lobos. And Alison came along with her kid and we just practiced about 5 or 6 songs. So we went out on the stage and, of course, working with somebody like Alison and working in that kind of environment where you know Odetta's going to come out and Harry Belafonte's like, these people are people who worked for the equality of black people forever and ever. And this is a tribute to Lead Belly, who's probably one way or another by all manner of musicians has been, you know, used gratuitously. But when I walked out with Alison, I had a suit on. And I had Alison next to me with her fiddle and her bow looking at me, and those eyes were twinkling. And she said, "Robert, just try and sing the same thing twice. Then I can harmonise with you, because otherwise it's going to sound a mess." And I went, "Oh, OK, I never thought about that." It was good, good stuff.
Some sunny day, baby, when everything seems OK, baby, you wake up and find that you're alone, because I'll be gone. Street, baby, we'll ask you why you're walking all alone and why you're on your own, and just say I'm gone, 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 'cause you done me wrong.
Go on stage with the band, because it's a really interesting moment that before it starts, because it's like a pact. The audience know something is about to happen, so do the band, and the audience could have seen that band the previous night and it would be completely different, and you could play the same set and it would be completely different. And there's that, we all understand that something's about to happen, and when I've seen you play, when it does start happening, it's like you're not conducting it, you're kind of, you're a sort of man sort of standing in a field in the middle of a storm, like enjoying it happen around him. That moment before, that first step onto the stage.
Well, there's a lot of nervous energy. I mean, I remember in the great chaos of the 70s, when there was no security, no nothing going on, and there was this anticipation, and you got 67,000 people standing up in the Pontiac Silverdome or something like that, and... it's so terrifying.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can't imagine.
And there was no order. So, you know, but now it's fantastic because we are such a brotherhood. the space shifters, we laugh so much, and they take the mickey out of me, quite rightly. They pretend to be reverential, but I know they're only taking the mickey. So, and also, they're quite right in doing so, because each one of them shines like a star. So we all huddle, and we do this thing where we arms around each other's shoulders, lean in, right foot forward, toes together, and we do this long, long primal and on and on and on. And then when we let it go, we just lean back, let it go, and everybody exhales, and everybody's got a red face, and then we just go straight out and hit it. And then we find out whether we're any good.
But it still feels like that step into I don't know where my
foot's going
to land. It's
brilliant. It's wonderful. I remember going to see Neil Young once, and he said he was doing some push-ups. He said, "Come in, Richard." And happy Scorpio. And he said, "Come and join us." So we were locked in going, ha, 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 ha. I went, "Oh, no, I can't be doing this. I've got to get out." I mean, that was a preparation for singing Southern Man. You know? we do it. That's what we do. And then we hit it. And then we find out within the next 5 or 10 minutes whether we've got it that night.
What's the final song we should play? You get to choose the final song.
Try from, this is a true hippie request, I hope. Well, Joni Mitchell put out a double album about 10 years ago on Nonesuch called Travelogue. And there's a track on that called Amelia. And if there is a story to my life, it's that song.
What do you mean?
It's just transience. It's brilliant, you know, the freedom of the world. And the way she summarizes it and brings it together, it's just so it's on it, right on the top of it.
Then that's the song we should finish on. It's very good to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you too.
I was driving across the burning desert when I spotted 6 jet planes leaving 6 white vapor trails across the bleak terrain, like the hexagram of the heavens, like the strings of my guitar. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. The drone of flying engines is a song so wild and blue. It scrambles time and seasons if it gets through to you. Then your life becomes a travelogue full of picture postcard charms. Just a false alarm. People will tell you where they've gone. They'll tell you where to go, but till you get there yourself, you never really know. And where some have found the paradise, others just come to harm. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. That he was here tonight. It's so hard to obey the sad request of me to kindly stay away.
first and charmed. I tell Amelia, 'twas just a false alarm. Of aviation, she was swallowed by the sky or by the sea. Like me, she had a dream to fly. Like Icarus ascending on beautiful, foolish eyes. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. Maybe I've never really loved. I guess that is the truth. I've spent my whole life in clouds at icy altitudes and looking down on everything. I crashed into his arms. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. Cactus Tree Motel to shower off the dust, and I slept on strange pillows of my wanderlust. I dreamed of 747s over geometric miles. Dreams, dreams and false alarms.
Six Music.
I'm just interested in just mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Old Noughties on BBC Sounds.